Our speaker tonight, he's one of the first people I met when I came into recovery just a little over a couple years ago. And every time he shared and brought his experience to for me to listen to, I learned something. I can't really tell you what it was, but I always learned something. You know, over the years that I've been in recovery, I could just pick up the phone and call him. And if I had any questions or problems, he would be there if I needed him. And I used to go to 8111 quite a lot in the first year of my recovery to the 545 meeting. And I would say 95% of the time he was always there. And he just came up and gave me a hug. I was just miserable when I came into the program, and he just was there for me. He's like a big teddy bear. And with that, I will give you Michael P.
Well, my name is Michael, and I'm addicted to whatever you have. And who would have ever thought drinking and drugging would lead you to speaking in front of a room full of people behind a podium? And nervous and dropping pens and all kind of stuff. But it's really a pleasure to be here. And Dawn, I want to thank you. And as I told her, you know, I was thinking about what I wanted to open up with saying, and that's about the only thought I put into this. And you know, it's really a privilege to be able to go back today and to share in the pain and the misery that I inflicted upon people that loved me, because that's something for me to stay in touch with, and it's so easy to forget. And unfortunately, when you're wrapped up in your addiction, you don't care too much about people outside of yourself. And I didn't become aware of the pain that I caused people until I got away from the drugs and the alcohol. And today it's nice to love. Today it's nice to be loved. I had a very dear friend that said, you know, I used to have the kind of friends that'd steal my dope and help me look for it. And I did. And that was the kind of life I had for way too many years. And today's pretty awesome. You know, if I don't make a meeting at 8111 more than a couple of days in a row, then the phone starts ringing and people want to know if I'm okay. And, you know, that's the way this thing works. But to qualify myself, I'm very young. I'm only about, 35, 34, I don't know. No, actually, I'm 49 years old, coming up on 50 in about probably another 4 or 5 months, and drank and drug for about 26, 27 years, somewhere around there. Moved to California. I grew up in a nice upper middle class family, and Dad did a real good job at providing for us. Wasn't real good at knowing how to convey love, but you know, I had a mother who went overboard feeling the need to fill those gaps. And Dad was more of a provider, was more of your drill sergeant type persona. You know, he was the disciplinarian. And, you know, life was pretty normal when I lived here in Atlanta, Georgia, up to moving to San Francisco in the early 60s. And then we moved to San Francisco in the early 60s, and life really took a change. And what's amazing looking back on it was it really didn't do it with me right away. I was the third of four kids. My older brother and sister pretty much right away started doing drinking and drugging. And, you know, for whatever reason, unbeknownst to me, I chose to make healthy choices for a while. Go figure. But, you know, the big book tells you that an alcoholic and addict drinks for one reason and one reason only, and that's that we like the sense of ease and comfort. And I didn't drink and I didn't drug and I didn't turn to those things for my answers until I had a need for that sense of ease and comfort that life didn't provide for me otherwise. And I am one of these that firmly believes, as a plaque on the wall in 8111 says, that the only reason a person will drink is because they want to. And there was a guy named Doc Crandall that said that, and I do believe that today. I don't have a reason on earth to drink today other than the fact that I just make a choice to do so, or to do a drug. And I do believe, though, that events in life can act as a catalyst to us making bad decisions. And, you know, for me, that's exactly what happened. You know, I as I think Dawn has shared with a few people, when I moved to San Francisco, I played the drums and, you know, was fortunate enough to hook up with Mickey Hart, who was a drummer for the Grateful Dead, long before the Dead became famous. And actually, he and his dad, Leonard Hart, had a music company in San Carlos, California, and believe it or not, sold musical instruments and taught the drums. And I started taking lessons from Mickey and became, for whatever reason, one of his little star pupils that he'd fly around and put in little contests and here and there, and had an opportunity of doing drugs a lot earlier than I did, getting surrounded by some of the people that I did. Actually went to school with, I was telling Don Neil Sean, who was lead guitar player for Journey. He was in my class in high school, and we were actually in a rock and roll band together that would play at school dances and stuff like that, you know, up to Neil dropping out of school his sophomore year in high school and joining Santana. And I guess the reason I'm pointing all of that out is that I was around these people for quite a while with them drinking and drugging before I chose to participate in that. You know, and I chose to make healthy choices. I chose not to turn to that. I just, something deep down inside knew the day that I did that I wasn't going to be able to control it, you know, because before I got involved in it, I saw people not controlling it. And ironically, you know, just really going in a different direction, call it obsessive compulsive or whatever, but at 13 years old, I also worked for Bobby Kennedy when he ran for president. And was very, very, very heavily involved in that campaign, and actually had the pleasure of meeting him and a lot of his family members and getting involved in a really, really extensive way. And pretty much lived from the minute I got out of high school till, or actually it was junior high school at the time, you know, would go straight to the campaign headquarters and work until my mom picked me up and took me home and it was time to eat dinner and go to bed. And it was his assassination that was really a catalyst to my turning to drugs. And, he got murdered a couple of days before my 13th birthday. And within a week of him being murdered, I drank my first liquor. And it was a bottle of scotch I stole out of my dad's liquor cabinet. And I'll tell you something, I went out with some friends that night. We camped out in the woods. I drank that whole bottle of scotch myself, you know, everybody had their own stuff, and, got drunk, got sick, puked all over myself, fell down in a creek, busted my knee open, woke up the next day and wanted to do it again. You know, it was like, man, it was just amazing. I mean, there was absolutely nothing enjoyable about it other than the fact that for a very brief moment, I just didn't feel anymore. And, you know, at that particular time with what was going on in life, you know, that was a big attraction to me. That was a huge magnet. And I was off to the races. You know, within probably 2 weeks of stealing that bottle of liquor out of my dad's cabinet, I bought my first bag of pot. San Francisco, needless to say, was a bevy of drugs at the time. You know, you had good old Orange Barrel and Purple Microdot from over there at UC Berkeley, and, you know, had a lot of hash and a lot of opium and stuff like that coming in on the boats. And you know, bottom line is that I used and abused everything I touched, and was off to the races. And that's the way life was. We were laughing on the way over here, you know, about the fact that I wore out California, looking back on it, because my dad had an opportunity to transfer back here from San Francisco when I was just going into my senior year in high school. And I didn't want to come back, needless to say, and was having a blast out there and, you know, just wanted to stay and keep doing my thing. And, you know, somehow I was conniving enough to where I convinced my parents it'd be a good thing. And we actually talked to one of my best friend's parents, and I was going to stay with them in their house. I had a little 65 Mustang convertible that I'd gotten my driver's license on, and they were going to leave me that car. You know, and life was great, man. I was going to have my surfboard, and I was going to have my car, and I was going to be living with my friends and doing my drugs. And, you know, unfortunately, about 2 weeks before my parents moved, I got popped for a bag of pot. And the only punishment I had was washing police cars every other weekend for a month. And then they thought it was a real good idea that I go home with my mom and dad to Georgia. And thus came the end to my dream of being able to stay out there and live out there and keep doing my same thing. And, You know, I really, really thought I was unlucky for a long, long time. You know, I thought that was probably one of the worst things in the world that had ever happened to me, you know, because looking back on it, you know, it was like for a long time, you know, I questioned the fact that here I was running around with this, you know, wonderful musically social group. You know, they were all on their paths to getting rich and famous and, you know, had opportunities going on all around me. And, you know, the what ifs kick in. It's like, you know, what if I hadn't gotten caught with that bag of pot? You know, what if I'd been able to stay out there? What if I'd been able to continue hanging out with those people? And, you know, what if, you know, something had led to me playing the drums in a band on a stage and all of that? And today, quite honestly, I think that's the first time God actually intervened and stepped in and saved my life. Because I know the what if today. And if I had stayed out there on the path that I had started to travel, I wouldn't be here today. I'd be dead. Because there would have been no one to try to control. And believe you me, my parents tried for a lot of years, and they did so very unsuccessfully. You know, I moved here in 71. You know, it's just amazing how you can move from the West Coast to the East Coast. And, you know, within about probably 2 weeks, I knew where I could buy me some pot. You know, it didn't take me long at all. As a matter of fact, I'm looking at one of the culprits I used to party with. We ran into each other in recovery a little while back. You know, and glad that we did. But it's just kind of funny how, you know, you can seek out, you know, when that's what you want. And, you know, I came here, I just, you know, continued that same path. You know, got in a lot of trouble here. I mean, I've been in, you know, if, you know, it's kind of funny. I hear people say, you know, let me qualify myself. I drank for so many years. Well, you know, I drank and drugged for a lot of years, but I think I've got about a 3 or 4 page police report, you know, unfortunately, that is also more than ample qualification for a lot of arrests, but, you know, no convictions, you know, because I had a magical father. You know, it was amazing how he did not know what to do for me. You know, it baffled the hell out of him. And he tried in everything he knew how to do. But the only thing he knew how to do was to get me out of trouble. He didn't know how to keep me from getting in trouble. And he was an expert at somehow picking up the phone and getting prosecutors on the phone and getting judges on the phone and just making things go away. You know, which just unfortunately didn't do me a bit of good. I mean, I was never getting around to addressing the problem. And folks, I don't know, you know, what you think the problem is, but I don't have a problem with drinking and drugging. I guarantee you I can do it just as good, if not better, than anybody in this room. The problem was me. And, you know, my dad didn't live long enough to find that out. And, you know, that's, if you look back on it, that's probably, I don't necessarily know that I call it a regret, because I do believe he can look down on things today from where he's at, and he's pretty happy with what I'm trying to do with myself and where I've come from where I was. But I do wish that he had lived long enough for me to figure out, you know, this part of the journey. And unfortunately, he didn't. I was drinking and drugging right up through him dying of cancer in 83. And it's sad. You know, as I said, when I started out, I was absolutely blind to pain and chaos I was causing other people. You know, I just didn't see it. And I wish I had a dollar for every time I had a loved one ask me, why are you doing this to yourself? You know, I don't know if y'all ever had that asked of you, but, you know, I'd had that asked of me a lot. And I can honestly say my response was always, what are you talking about? You know, I didn't understand. What do you mean? What am I doing to myself? You know, and I was one of these kind of people that, you know, I've heard that the longer I get sober, the sicker I was. And that's definitely true for me. You know, the further I get away from that last drink, you know, you also hear that you're closer to it. But the further I get away from it, the more I become aware of the behaviors I had, you know, the lack of beliefs and the lack of morals I had, you know, spiritual principles. It's like, you know, what was that? You know, I had none of that. Believed in God, you know, was raised in God, but, you know, wasn't a part of God. I was one of these when I came into recovery that, you know, when you started saying that God thing, it wasn't that I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I just didn't feel a part of it. You know, I was very unworthy. If you had lived the life I had lived, I firmly believe that there was a God and that I saw him do miracles for other people. but that I had earned my spot on the opposing team because I didn't live a Christian life. I didn't live a life worthy of having a God in my life that loved me. And that's why I didn't want to have anything to do with it. You know, that was just something that you know, never worked for me. And, you know, looking back on it, too, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. I can actually say that my Christian upbringing led me on many an occasion to going into a church and getting on my knees, you know, in a pew and begging God to save my life. You know, save me. You know, I don't know what the hell is going on. You know, I don't know how the hell to stop this. You know, please don't let it happen again kind of thing. And, you know, alcohol wasn't really my drug of choice. It was more the other stuff, you know. And I just, you know, I was a wimp when it came to hangovers. That's the only reason alcohol wasn't my drug of choice. You know, if I went out and I got drunk, you know, it was one of these things where I had to curl up on the couch in a fetal position and wanted everybody to stay away from me and don't breathe, it's too loud kind of thing. You know, and that's the reason I think I liked reefer so much, because I could smoke that stuff and I could operate. You know, I was actually a functioning addict. Cocaine's another story. Why the hell I ever turned to that shit, I don't know, because I'm hyperactive as it is. And, man, you talk about bouncing off the walls. You know, that and Quaaludes, those were good for a while, but they took them away from us, you know, damn it. You know. And that was probably about the closest thing to a barbiturate that I think I ever liked. You know, I didn't like pills, but those Quaaludes, those things were good. The only thing I didn't like about them was it seemed like every time they came into town, somebody I knew died. You know, and that is definitely an association that I firmly remember having with Quaaludes. You know, I was glad they were there. I was very anxious to find the person who had them and buy some, but then it always seemed like somebody died. And, you know, that's kind of what it was like. And it was not fun. I don't know how many of y'all are sitting here today, and it's kind of funny. I was laughing a little bit earlier because there was a time where I would sit in an AA meeting and hear somebody share about a treatment center, and I would kind of like harbor this little inner resentment for a minute, you know, because it was like, you know, these people would raise their hands and they'd share and they'd say, you know, I hate it. I'm in this treatment center and I'm having to do this and that. And they're telling me to do this and that. And I have to do this and that and eat this and that and go here and there. And I'd sit there and I'd think, I can't believe they're whining, you know. And it would piss me off because I always got that go direct to jail card. You know, I never got to do this thing. And I would always wake up either on the other side of the bars or the other side of the plexiglass. And, you know, nobody wanted to pay attention to you. You know, they didn't want to talk to you. They didn't care when you needed to use the bathroom. There was one that everybody got to use, you know. And you got fed at a certain time. And if you didn't like the temperature of it or didn't like the way it tasted, there were no choices. And, you know, that's you know, the way that was. And you know, I consider treatment to be a blessed thing today. I am one of these to where I can tell you I'm kind of a poster child for the wonderful world of Cobb County. Because my attorney did a good job at convincing a judge that alternative sentencing was a good idea for me rather than me sitting in jail for a very long time. And I'm the very first one that out of all of the people that my probation officer, which he happened to be the oldest probation officer in Cobb County, had ever handled, that I had to go on house arrest and things like that for a long duration of time, didn't go back to jail. And actually ended up having them let me off of house arrest a few months early. And, you know, it's just, I'll get to that part in a minute. But, you know, I just don't want to go back to what it was like. You know, today I do have friends that love me. I do have a wonderful purpose in life. Today I do have principles, you know, and today life is more about trying to bring something to it every day instead of trying to take from it and get out of it. You know, it's amazing how I was never about anybody's needs other than my own. And today, honestly, my best days are when other people pick up the phone and they need, you know, and I love that. I love that. This is exactly what I absolutely love where I'm at in life today. I love recovery. And the only thing I could encourage anybody who's early in it is, for God's sakes, hang on to it. Because all of this stuff does come for you, you know. But I was reading one of my daily meditations this morning, and you know, it was talking about that unfortunately too many of us come in here and we try too hard to get this thing, you know. And it said, let it just happen, you know, because if you just let it happen and if you believe and you just continue to come and you continue to let people in recovery influence you, things do change. just like people influenced you when you just chose to turn to drugs and alcohol. You know, I didn't know everything about that world either. I had to learn it. You know, when I chose to turn to it, you know, and embrace it, I had to hang around people that knew that, you know, and to teach me how to do it, you know, and to teach me how to not get to ripped off when I bought a bag of pot, or, you know, teach me how to buy a good Coke, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, you've got to be taught this thing too. You know, I was explained that that's why the big book has a blank page in the front. That's how little I knew about what I was trying to find when I came to the wonderful world of recovery. What happened, which I think is the next step of this journey, is the great enabler died. And my dad passed away in 83, and up until 1983, I always got out of my trouble. You know, he, like I said, he was a miracle worker. And getting out of my trouble enabled me to live that much of my life without ever having to face me. But you know what? What Dad, unfortunately, when he was gone, didn't take away my problems. And unfortunately, getting me out of the consequences didn't do anything about what I was doing that caused those consequences. And I can tell you that I did real good. You know, considering the amount of time I'd spent in drugs and alcohol up to that point, I went about another 12 years before I came in contact with me. And for about 12 years, I drank and drugged, you know, just partied my ass off, you know, just, I mean, it's amazing how many times I drove my car home and God only knows how it got there. You know, I can actually say that there's been a couple of occasions where I lost my car, you know, and people that drink normal and you know, I used to say drug normal, but nobody does that. But people that drink normal don't lose their car. And there were more than one occasion where I'd have to go back with friends the next day and kind of backtrack and try to figure out where it dropped off the way, you know, somewhere during that evening before. And, you know, in 1995, I got a DUI in Fulton County. And that was when I was introduced to the world of recovery. I'm, again, one of these kind of people where there's a little bit of sensationalism to what I do, and I don't just go out and get normal DUIs. I had to total 5 cars on 400 northbound. And it was at 10 minutes till 6 on a Thursday afternoon, and it was about a half a mile north of the lanes that come in from 285 merging onto 400 northbound. And I shut the whole damn freeway down. And I can tell you, I mean, to give you an idea of how much I had my stuff together, I had a brand new little Mazda MX-6, was in sales at the time, had gotten a raise that day, and went to one of these wonderful establishments, you know, where the women show the shoes, and decided to celebrate, you know, getting my raise that day. And you been there? No. But I went out to celebrate getting my raise that day. And you know, it's kind of funny. I didn't think I had a drinking problem, but I was already trying to do something about it. And I didn't realize the connections until I went through the big book the first time. But this is prior to ever having walked into a room of an AA meeting. And do you know, I had already switched from beer to tequila. And I want you to know the reason I switched from beer to tequila was because I would go out and drink beers with my friends. And I would drink it so fast that, you know, when I was gone, mine was gone, I'd order another one. And when that's gone, I'd order another one. Well, I cannot tell you how many times I was sitting at a table with a bunch of friends, and all of a sudden they got 3 or 4 beers sitting in front of them wondering why the hell I'm ordering another one, and I'm pissed off because I'm buying the rounds. You know, and it's like, well, you know what? If you're not going to drink them, give them to me. And I got tired of doing that. And buying the rounds led me to thinking that I ought to change. You know, so I went to tequila. And honestly, because I hated the taste of it. And my whole, now in case y'all haven't done this, I'm going to share this with you. So in case you're thinking about doing it, I'm going to let you know it doesn't work. My whole thing was that, you know, I'll get a shot of tequila and I'll get a glass of soda water. And what I'll do is I'll chase it, you know, I'll slam the tequila and then I'll chase it with the soda water, you know, take care of that taste. And then I'll sit there and I'll sip the soda water, you know, and then this way I can control my drinking. Yeah, did you try that too? Well, that didn't work. You know, it never dawned on me that when the tequila's gone, The bartender's educated to ask you if you want another tequila, even if you have a full glass of soda water. And that particular day that I went out, the only thing I can remember is she started out with a water glass, giving me like a little bit of tequila in the bottom of it. And by the time I drank the last couple of them I drank, I can remember I had to like really try to get it to my mouth to keep from spilling any, because by then I was tipping her so good that she was filling those suckers up. And man, I was still slamming them down. And got in my car. I forgot to leave out a real good part for y'all. I also had full custody of a daughter at this point. This particular day that I went out drinking to celebrate my raise. And got in my car, got on 285, heading to 400, was on 400's entrance ramp from 285 westbound, talking on my cell phone, holding it with my shoulder, steering with my knees and writing on one of those dashboard notepads after having drank all that tequila. And I tell you what, I had it down. I really thought my shit was together. And then I came around the corner, and unfortunately the guy in front of me swerved around the car in front of him. I remember catching a glimpse of that because the traffic was at a dead stop and it was clicking pretty good going around the entrance ramp. And when he swerved, I thought, well, that was a good idea. I'll try to swerve. And unfortunately for me to swerve far enough out to avoid him took me into the northbound lane. And my left front corner ended up hitting the right front corner of a car coming northbound and collapsed both of our wheels and sent us both in spins. And by the time it was all said and done, it looked like a war scene out of Lebanon or somewhere like that. It was absolutely nothing but teetotal destruction. And when I say I totaled five cars, I totaled them. How I did not kill somebody that day, I do not know. And God bless me with the fact that I injured a man and nothing more than that. It was a very slight break in his leg. I can remember like it happened 2 seconds ago, watching the police put him on a stretcher. In all of my years of alcohol and drug abuse, I had never hurt anyone other than myself, you know, except emotionally. I was, you know, ignorant to that emotional pain, but physically I had never done anything to anyone. I also forgot to mention that by this time I had also been in a couple of car wrecks where I had been pronounced dead two times to my father. I actually totaled a car the night before Thanksgiving when I was 19, and they told him at Northside Hospital I wouldn't live through the night. And the only reason I didn't get a DUI for that one was my blood pressure was 16/6 when I got to the hospital. And that didn't even slow me down. You know, I mean, I forgot to even mention that, but, you know, I went home from the hospital after a couple of weeks in a coma and being flat on my back for about 6 weeks. And, you know, they sent me home with the intention of staying in bed for about 3 months. And within a week, I was up on crutches, out in a car, getting high with a friend. And I can remember I went to a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert at the Fox, standing in line on my crutches, got messed up on the way down there, you know, obviously physically wasn't up to it. The next thing I remember, I passed out and I'm laying on the floor and a bunch of people looking over saying, "You okay?" And sure, I was okay. I just, you know, needed to smoke another joint. So I got up, went to the concert, and that's the crazy kind of stuff I did. But when I had back to that DUI on 400, that's the one that led me to recovery. And that was the first time ever that somebody suggested that I go to an AA meeting. And of all people, of course, it was an attorney. You know, it's like, you know, this is a very good thing for you to do. And by the way, here's these forms, and I strongly suggest that you maybe get some proof that you were there, so ask these lovely people to sign it for you. And that's what led me to recovery. And I can remember the first meeting I walked into was 11:30 at 8111. And I walked in, I sat down. Of course, my whole life is chaos inside. You know, I'm just busting out of my skin. I'm crying. I'm scared to death. You know, I don't know what's going to come of life. And, you know, I've caused all of this crap. And guess what? Daddy's not around. Very important part. And I went in and I sat down in an AA meeting. And I can remember, like it happened 5 minutes ago, one of the first things that really caught me off guard was the laughter. And my sponsor likes to call it the music of alcoholics. But I couldn't believe that I was sitting in a room full of people whose lives were supposed to be like mine, and they were laughing. And I tell you something else too, it was a laughter I had never heard before in my life. It was real. And see, up until going into those rooms, laughter was my best defense mechanism. If I laughed and I was happy and I was jovial and I had a smile on my face and all of that, then I didn't have to talk about what was really going on with me. And it's just amazing how happy I was. So I went into AA that day. And contrary to what I had been taught, you know, I was raised that, you know, the alcoholic was the old guy standing on the street corner with raincoat on, bumming change for a drink. And, you know, there were no raincoats. You know, I couldn't figure it out. You know, and the parking lot was full of nice cars, you know, Mercedes and Acuras. And it's like, man, I'm in the wrong place. And I listened to what they were talking about. And what was amazing was these people were laughing about the chaos they used to have in their life. And I thought, wow, you know, this is wild. And, you know, being a shy person and all of that, I did want to share in that meeting that day, but I didn't. That's one of the few times in my life ever that I've been able to keep my mouth shut. And I didn't want to change the tone of the meeting, which is probably the only reason on earth I kept my mouth shut. You know, it was a very happy place, you know, when people were talking about good stuff. And I knew if I opened my mouth, I'd cry. And, you know, I just didn't want to do that to those people. And so I grabbed the guy after the meeting, who happened to be the discussion leader, was a pilot for Delta. I still see him occasionally there. And we went off in the other room, and, you know, I started doing exactly what I knew I'd do. I started crying, you know, just crying my eyes out and telling him how terrible, you know, life was, what I had done to myself. And he literally interrupted me at some point, and he said, "Shut up." Now I'm like, damn, you know, that's real compassionate, you know, and I'm sitting here with a river going down my face, and he tells me to shut up. And he looked at me and says, "Would you like me to finish it for you?" And it was like, no. And he says, "Well, then let me tell you something." He says, "I don't want to sound like I'm being mean. I don't want to interrupt you. It's not like I don't care." But he says, you're in a place where everybody can tell you everything about where you've come from. And what we want to talk to you about is where you can go from that point. And that's what AA is all about. And he sat there and he gave me this little analogy, which I absolutely love to this day. And it might sound Mickey Mouse to you, but at the time, there was just something about it that stuck with me. But he said, "Remember when you were about 6 or 7 years old and you woke up on a Saturday morning and there was no school?" And he says, "It was kind of cool outside and you looked out and it was sunny and the sky was blue and the trees were green. And you got up and started putting your clothes on and you could smell your mom cooking bacon in the kitchen. And you just couldn't wait to run in there and scarf your breakfast down so you could jump on your bike and feel that wind going through your hair." And I'm sitting there with all those tears rolling down my face going, "Yeah, you know, what the hell's this got to do with what I was talking to you about?" And he looks at me and he says, "All of that's still out there. It's exactly the same. The only thing that has changed at all is the way we look at it. And all of that is still out there today. And I've gotten in touch with a lot of it. No, I don't ride my bike anymore, and I'm a little bit older, and Mom doesn't cook me breakfast. But, you know, the rest of it's still true to form." And you would think that DUI would have been enough. But I went to AA every single day for 2 years and 11 months. And I never did anything other than go to meetings for 2 years and 11 months. See, I went long enough. At first, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I went because I had a problem with DUIs. And what was funny was when I finally got, you know, the nerve to share, I would share that. And I'd tell people, you know, "I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I'm here because I got a problem with DUIs." And it would bring out the laughter. And they just didn't realize how serious I was. You know, because if you knew how many drugs I did and how little I drank and the fact that I had four DUIs, then you'd know I'm just unlucky. And that's exactly the way I looked at it. And today, quite the contrary, the way I look at it is I take 29 years times 365 minus 4, and I look at how many DUIs I got away with. Because I was DUI every single day. You know, my drug of choice wouldn't have been found unless they took a blood test. But had they taken a blood test, I was under the influence of a mind-altering substance for 26, 27, 28 years of my life, something like that. And again, I went to those meetings for 2 years and 11 months. And even, I'll tell you, I was manipulative. I spent about a year finding a sponsor because I knew if I looked hard enough, I'd find one that'd co-sign all my bullshit. You know, and they're there. If you look hard enough, you can find them. That's why they say a competent sponsor. And see, I spent a year in a lot of intensive study finding one that would not give me any grief about my way of doing things, would not give me any grief about not calling, and just as long as I was in a meeting, you know, and was still visibly a part of the program, hey, you know, I'm working it. And, yeah, it worked for me. You know, that was the extent of which I wanted to put the effort into it. I like to point out that I went for 2 years and 11 months because, looking back on it, ironically, it took me 2 years and 7 months to go to court for that DUI. So you do the math. And for 2 years and 7 months, I was getting my little slip signed and getting my signatures to help me get out of my consequences. And when I went to court, I got out of them. You know, got my community service out of the way, went to jail for 2 weeks, you know, paid my fines, got my license back, you know, did all that stuff, and just no big deal, you know, just got it all put behind me, and continued to go to meetings for 2 more months. I mean, it's amazing. Looking back on it, after all the consequences were said and done, I still hung in there for 60 days, doing it my way. And 60 days later, all it took was my boss, of all people, suggesting to me at lunch one day that I could have a beer with him. And you know what, folks? I had never worked the steps, and so I had never, ever done anything about building up a defense against that next drink or the next drug. And all it took was somebody suggesting it. And I can remember, like it just happened, the conversation that it took place, because I was sitting at the table with three guys. They were all drinking. I'd done real good up to this point, drinking my soda waters without tequila. And that day, they're all like, well, man, it's been 2 years and 11 months. You know, how could you have a problem? You haven't done a thing. Well, having done nothing to change the way my mind works, I thought, wow, they're right. That's exactly what my mind thought. Now, let me tell you the way the alcoholic mind thinks, too, or at least mine does. I thought, okay, well, if they're right, then I can do this. But I can't drink beer because I can never control that. So it's like my mind X the beer off. And then I thought, no, damn sure ain't going to go back to that tequila, you know, so X that off. Wine. I had never liked wine. And I didn't like sweet things either, so white Zinfandel. And then I tell you, even taking it a step further, I thought, okay, I'll get white Zinfandel. I don't like it. It's too sweet. So I'll put ice in it. Because then the ice waters it down a little bit, cuts the sweetness. And if I put ice in it, then it's really only a half a glass of wine. And that's a good thing. And so that's what I did. And I had me a half a glass of white Zinfandel on ice that day at lunch. And I want you to know, I went back to my office that day, and so help me God, I walked out into my plant, and I thought, see, those people in AA, they don't know what the hell they're talking about. You know, I just successfully went out and drank, and I controlled it, and I knew what I was doing, and I didn't abuse it, and all this kind of stuff. And I did it the next day. And you know what? I controlled it just as good. And did it for about 3 months, and nothing really changed. But about 3 months later, bought a bag of pot. You know, and back to smoking the pot after I put my daughter to bed at night kind of thing. You know, I was always a good parent and would wait till after I put her to bed. And then I was one of those that hung out by myself in the bathroom. You know, where's the fun in that? Sitting there looking at yourself, this is fun, man. You know, and you know, looking back on it, it's like, God, you know, some are sicker than others. You know, and I was a sick puppy. And, you know, within about a month of getting back into the reefer, lo and behold, the Cokes crept back in. And 6 months later, I was back out there over a period of about 6 months later, of about 6 months. 6 months later was the first time that 2 years and 11 months did me any good whatsoever. And I tell people that, you know, I got this thing down so packed that I graduated from it and I woke up with honors from Cobb County. And I woke up in the Chateau de Cobb County right up the street. You know, that 2 years and 11 months, I do like to point out that I did learn one thing. I learned how to go from being a dangerous drunk to a safe drunk because, you know, of course, the one before I had totaled the 5 cars. Well, this one, I had a Mitsubishi 3000 GT, a bright red one. And I got pulled over because I was going 27 miles an hour up 75 north. And it was at 10 o'clock at night. And And a good Samaritan called the Georgia State Patrol on me, and they, of course, relayed it to Marietta. And the Marietta cop in court said that when he came upon the scene, that I had a parade of about 12 cars behind me, because here I am, like, in about six or seven lanes, and they are afraid to pass me, you know? And I'm going 27 miles an hour, you know? It's like wimps. But I got pulled over that night, woke up in jail thoroughly of the belief that somebody had drugged my drink, you know, and went and met with an attorney. And I mean, we went off on that tangent, man. It was like somebody put that date rape drug shit in my drink, you know. And because, like, you can look at my tab and you can tell I didn't even know what I was writing. You can't read what I tipped them. It's like, God, you talk about sweating a bill coming through on the credit card, because I didn't have a clue as to what they were going to total it out for. And fortunately, they were good enough to where they totaled it out without the tip, because you couldn't read it. And, you know, went off on this tangent that they had drugged my drink, and had the attorney pursuing that until he got the video from Marietta Police, you know, because these days they video you. And I can remember the day he called me and he got the video. He says, you know, you don't want to say that they drugged your drink. And he says, and I think we need to sit down and talk about what your defense is going to be. And so things kind of shifted there, and I got in touch with me. And again, I was facing me. And this time, of all places, it wasn't Fulton County, but it was Cobb County, and they love to prosecute DUIs up there. And the judge I had just happened to be the wife of Pat Head, who was the head prosecuting attorney, and, you know, they just love for people to go to jail for DUIs in Cobb County. And they're tough about it. And, you know, what's kind of funny, standing in front of you today as a drunk, I'm saying it's a damn good thing that they are, you know, because they needed to get people like me off the street. And I absolutely went back into AA on my knees. The first time that 2 years and 11 months did me any good whatsoever was when I came to on that holding cell floor, and I was laying on this floor in a suit, absent of my belt and my tie, staring at a toilet that was covered in piss and puke. They had had a roadblock out that night, and that holding cell is supposed to hold about 15 people, and I think they had about 60 in it. And I'm curled up in the middle of the floor, and I sat up on the floor. I pulled myself back to the wall. I put my head down to my knees, and I thought, oh, my God, not again. And in case you want to know it, the big book describes that as pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that is the first time the 2 years and 11 months that I came to AA doing it my way did me any good. That was the first time that I listened to any of all of that stuff that was in my head. And believe me, it was a long day that I had to listen to it, because I came to about 8 in the morning. My daughter had spent the night out that night. I had an obligation to pick her up by 6 o'clock in the afternoon, and the clock was ticking. And it took me about till about 4 o'clock that afternoon to get out. They don't let you out real easy these days. They make it very difficult to bond out, and they're making it even more difficult to bond out. And I had a friend who was willing to put his house up to get me out that I worked with. And just one of those little God shots. And, you know, I would have gone straight to an AA meeting, except that I thought more about my fellow AA members than that. And I went home and took a shower first. That was the first thing I did. And then I got my daughter, and we went to a meeting, and, you know, I didn't say anything about it. I wasn't about to, you know, at first I even debated on hiding it from her. You know, how the hell am I going to tell her I've done this again, kind of thing. And the next day I sat down with her and I just told her, I said, you know what? I said, your daddy messed up. And that was the first time in my life when I went back to AA to where I was absolutely in touch with the fact that I was up against something I could do nothing about and that I needed help. You know, I was getting my ass whipped and blind to it for a lot of years. And I didn't need anybody to tell me to go back in. I didn't need anybody to suggest it was a good idea. I didn't even go back in for slips until the attorney again told me it'd be a good idea to start getting them signed. And when I went to court, I'm very pleased to say that this time around, it took about 2.5 years to go to court again. And I'm very pleased to tell you that that's a little over 2 years ago. So this time getting my consequences behind me wasn't that big of an accomplishment. Doing something about me is bigger. And working the program properly, it's amazing how I tell people that this is without a doubt the biggest source of unconditional love I could have ever gotten on my knees and prayed for. because when I went to court that day, I actually had about 25 people go with me from AA. I think I had about 3,000 meetings or something like that that I had gotten signatures for in 2.5 years. I had probably 40 or 50 letters that were written on my behalf. And I tell you one thing about recovering alcoholics, they'll help you if you're helping yourself. You know, they're not going to help you if you're not. And if you think you can fool an alcoholic, you forget who they were before they found sobriety. You know, we were the best of the best. And, you know, to this day, Cobb County refers to that as the AA trial. And it was absolutely amazing. And I had a prosecutor pushing for me to serve no less than a year in jail. And I had total custody of my daughter, who was 13 at the time. Absolutely did not know what was going to happen. My sponsor says that I'm the first person he ever felt take a third step. And there was a day in the parking lot at 8111 that I spent about 4 hours with him because I was at that jumping off point, you know. And, you know, didn't have the guts to stick a gun in my mouth, you know, didn't want to overdose, you know, didn't. But if I could have just dissipated. You know, just done that thing you see on Star Trek where they go in the transporter room and just and go away. I'd have jumped on that. You know, I couldn't handle it. And I came to believe, you know, that day in a power greater than me and the fact that, you know what, I was in no control and that it was going to turn out exactly the way it was supposed to turn out and that all the worrying in the world wasn't going to do anything. And so I went into that courtroom just... Somehow, looking back on it, it's baffling, you know, the serenity I had and the peace I had. And, you know, it's amazing the spiritual experience it was. I mean, me and these 20-something people that went with me were holding hands and having circle prayers, you know, when they called my name. And they came in and you know, just having them there and knowing there was a visual support. You know, I've also got to say, when they were describing me going up the freeway, the policeman reading his report, you know, from 2.5 years ago and everything, it was kind of funny. The whole room laughed just like y'all did, and the judge did this, you know, and it was like, okay, all of a sudden you realize, you know, this isn't funny to her. And I can remember when they walked back through it, and the cop was describing exactly everything I had done. You know, I'd gone up, I'd exited the North Loop, went down to the first red light. And, you know, they're behind me this whole time, and I'm just not pulling over. And then I made a U-turn, ran the red light, and went back the other way. And by then, they had set up a roadblock. I leaned over to this guy next to me, and I said, damn, I guess I'm lucky I didn't get charged with eluding. And he looked at me and says, you were only going 27 miles an hour. And I was like, can't you see the cop running beside you saying, you know, pull over, pull over. You know, it's... You know, looking back on it, you know, that's the insanity of it all. And, you know, it's just amazing that I didn't go to jail for a year. It's just amazing that I didn't lose everything that I had in life up to that point. And I'll tell you, it's amazing what God can do if you get the hell out of the way and let Him. And that's what I try to do today. You know, I just don't try to run my life today, and I didn't try to run my life that day. I was totally in touch with the fact that I was out of control and that judge, I mean, she had to turn a recorder on and record the fact that I waived a jury trial, I waived all of my rights, and I put the deciding factor in her hands. And I just had faith in what I had done and the fact that people were there that would back me up and that I knew, if nothing else, that I had tried to make a change in me. And I knew, if nothing else, that if I went to jail at that time, that there was something good that would come from it, you know. And I just had faith in that. And I had strangers, you know, complete strangers, women at AA that would come to me, and when I would share about the fear of my daughter, tell me, don't worry about it. We'll take care of her, you know. And all of that added up to being able to walk in that room that day just not consumed in fear, but instead relying on faith. And that judge had me stand in front of her from about 2 o'clock until about 5 o'clock. And I tell you what, I was on my feet in front of her that whole time. And that prosecutor brought in other prosecutors. You know, they're all whispering. They're letting the judge know they're there because she had started leaning, you know, towards this alternative sentencing. And he didn't want that to happen. And he was fighting for it not to. And instead, she put me on 9 months house arrest. And gave me 30 days in jail, which I had to go for 15. And all of a sudden, you know, this insurmountable thing that I had created in my life got past me. You know, now the house arrest thing was different. It didn't get passed as fast. I don't know if any of you have experienced that, but an 8-to-5 curfew Monday through Friday sucks. You know, but every time I got on my little pity pot and, you know, it was through. Now, I tell you, I don't know if y'all remember, because this is back in, let's see, it's 1999 or no, about 2001. That was a beautiful summer. I mean, it hardly ever rained and got up in highs around the 80s, 85 every day. And it was because I was on house arrest, just in case you don't know. And I'm very much a pool person and could not leave. And, so, you know, went through that, you know, got that dropped at 7 months because I did the first 7 months perfectly, you know, didn't mess with it. I decided I needed to do what I was told to do. And, you know, I've kind of applied that same philosophy today. You know, I need to do what I'm told to do because this thing on my head's for entertainment purposes only. You know, it's not for guidance. You know, I mean, my head's messed up. And if you take all the time I drank and drug and weighed against the time I've been blessed with sobriety, my instincts don't turn to this. You know, it is against my instincts to be standing in a room full of recovering alcoholics and addicts on a Friday night. You know, my instincts are to be out at the bar, you know, trying to pick up women and heading towards closing it down. And, you know, I'm enjoying life today. And it's because of the fact that I believe that people care about me and I'm listening to those people. And I believe that there is a better way to live today, and it's right behind here on these walls. And I listen to people tell me how to do that today. And I believe in progress, not perfection. You know, and I'm not expected to do this thing perfectly, and I'm not the man I want to be today, but I'm damn sure not the man I used to be. And every day I just try to get a little bit better. You know, I'm coming up on, God willing, 5 years, but you know what? I just decided I needed to get my ass in a book study again. I also decided, having been married a year ago, that, you know, I need to go back and do another four-step. Not on my wife. No. As a matter of fact, I was telling somebody the other day, you know, I used to say there's a great litmus test for where you're at in sobriety, and it's to go out and get stuck in rush hour traffic, and it'll definitely bring out where you're at. Today I say go out and get married. And it has nothing to do with her as much as it does that it's real easy to go to a meeting for an hour and sound real good, and even hang out for an hour before, an hour after, and do real good. But when you take that home to someone else and you try to practice those principles in all of your affairs, and you have a living, breathing, talking mirror that reflects you at you, you know, at night when you might want to let that guard down a little bit, then I realize, you know, I got a lot of work left to do on me. And today I'm blessed with the fact that, you know what, I don't have to be perfect anymore. And I'm not trying to please anybody today. You know, I'm blessed with having a God of my understanding in my life today. I'm blessed with having people that love me and care about me. And, you know, it's just, I didn't expect any of this stuff. You know, and I'm sure if y'all have come to enough meetings, you'll hear people say, you know, if you have made a list of what you want to get out of this thing and you look back on it a couple of years from now, you'd have sold yourself short. You know, that doesn't even say it for me. It's amazing how I've been given so many promises that aren't in those promises we read every day that, you know, I would have never dreamed would have come my way. And, you know, I just wanted to do something about the pain in my life when I came back in here. That's all I wanted. I was sick of hurting. And I am blessed today with a life that is just so far beyond anything in my wildest imagination. And it's enjoyable, it's pleasurable, you know, even the difficult moments. You know, I've learned that emotions are a God-given thing. You know, pain and all of that kind of stuff is a God-given thing that's meant to be experienced just as much as laughter is. And I don't run from that today, but I experience it. You know, and when I go through difficult moments today, I try to learn from them. And every time I go through one, it makes the next one a little bit easier. But I have rambled. I have worn out the clock. My wife's been showing me her watch for about the last 10 minutes. But honestly, it was an honor to come here and share this tonight. You know, the only thing I pray for when I start to tell my story is that it might have just touched one person in here, and maybe you heard something that might help in your journey. And the only thing that I would encourage you to do, for God's sakes, don't give it up. It's a hell of a lot better than what was, and I'd like to thank you all for having me here.
Thank you.
so much for sharing your story with us.